The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
What do you know about me?
I know that you're trapped here, and that you're trying to get back to the 29th century. I also know you've made a deal with the Germans. They're giving you supplies, helping you build a time machine.
I see I was both right and wrong about you. You're not a temporal agent, but you're here to do their bidding.
If you carry out your mission, if you make it back to the 29th century, you'll ignite a war that will devastate the timeline.
You've only heard one side of the story, Captain. The temporal agents who sent you here are a tyrannical sect, imposing their will on countless cultures throughout history.
They enforce the temporal accords, preserve the timeline.
They manipulate the timeline to serve their own needs. If you've ever dealt with them, then you know they do much more than watch history unfold. They interfere with events. They have an agenda.
So do you.
At least I don't hide my intentions. It's true. I don't agree with the temporal accords. I believe that time travel is a technology no different than your warp drive, to be utilized for the benefit of all species. Societies and cultures can be improved through careful manipulation of historical events.
Who decides what improvements are needed?
I won't be drawn into a philosophical discussion.
Hello, everyone. It's Thursday, November 23rd, 2023. I'm Robert Vaughn.
And I'm Paul McKeever.
And this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online.
Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right-wing, it's just right.
Color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
Like it or not, we're stuck in this timeline, so we better learn to deal with it. And dealing with it involves philosophy. This timeline is marked by key events. One such event is the attack on the United States on September 11, 2001, by Islamic terrorists led by Osama bin Laden. Just over a year after this massacre of almost 3,000 civilians on that fateful day, he published what he called his Letter to America. In it, bin Laden told the world why he attacked and what he expected of Americans in return. Bin Laden at the time was a man who positioned himself as the sole spokesman for the religion of Islam. He was a self-styled pope, and his letter was his encyclical, an ex post facto manifesto. After the October 7th Hamas massacre in Israel, we saw many people discover bin Laden's letter for the first time. To them, it became a rationalization for the murder of innocent civilians and a wake-up call to the United States' forever war. It was as if these people had never saw the protests against the war in Vietnam over the decades, or the worldwide condemnation of the United States for their violent interference into the affairs of foreign states, even though there was no existential threat to the United States since 1945. Ukraine comes to mind. These people expressing their epiphany on TikTok, a sample of which we'll play in a moment, acted surprised and even elated at their discovery of bin Laden's letter. They admitted that up to that discovery, they'd been ignorant of bin Laden's motives and ignorant of the forever war. Well, I submit that they're still ignorant. Paul, what are your thoughts on these people's reactions on reading 21 years after the fact bin Laden's letter to America?
Well, most of the people I saw reading this letter to America were about 21 years old, so it didn't surprise me that they had very little firsthand knowledge of what went on or the horrors of what went on. Like the rest of us who were at least, say, 40 years old, you know, we saw the planes hitting the towers. We saw what happened after the fact. We saw that the people dancing in the streets in the Middle East very gleefully celebrating the fall of the two towers. This letter to America, as it's being called, which I don't think it originally was titled that or anything, if in fact it was written by Osama bin Laden, and I don't even know if that's true, it reads essentially like a modernized version of the Quran, really. If you've read the Quran, and probably some of our audience has, it is almost sort of a template for victim culture. In other words, everyone's out to come and get us, and therefore we righteously must defend ourselves because we hold the one true word of God. The Jews are referred to explicitly in the Quran as monkeys and pigs. That's part of the core document that's guiding Islam. So there's a feeling right in the founding book, which is supposed to be the word of God communicated through Gabriel to Prophet Muhammad. This is supposed to be the one true message that all the other messages have been, if you talk to, I'm talking modern day North American Muslim people, many of them will tell you that, oh, well, the Jews took the original word of God and then they bastardized it to make it look like it said this or that in their favor and et cetera. So the Christians are looked upon as the helpless dupes of the Jews. The Muslims are seen as the people who have to set the record straight and cleanse the world of what Judaism has done to the word of God. So when you read this letter to America, what you're seeing is a call to war against everyone who, in their view, tainted the word of God, challenges Islam, which is the one true way, the light, and etc. And their mission is not save Palestine. Their mission is global in scope. All we want is to make everyone Muslim. That's the letter. It says so explicitly.
Yes, you're right. The letter refers to two questions. Why did we attack? And what do we expect of you? And I'll read from the letter. It says, as for the second question that we want to answer, what are we calling you to do and what do we want from you? One, the first thing that we are calling you to Islam. The second thing we call you to do is to stop your oppression, lies, immorality, and debauchery that has spread among you. We call you to be a people of manners, principles, honor, and purity, to reject the immoral acts of fornication, homosexuality, intoxicants, gambling, and trading with interest. You be like us, you submit to the religion of submission, or we'll kill you.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Because as they see it, there's only one set of laws that belongs on this planet. They aren't made by man, they're made by God. And legislatures, there's reasons why they are targeted by the radicals, because legislatures are the places where men make laws for men. Democracy, in other words, government for the people, by the people, serving the people, not serving God, which is theocracy, right? In a theocracy, you don't make your own laws. You look to your holy book, your Ten Commandments, or your Hadith, or whatever else you want to treat as core documents, and say, we must comply with this. Women must cover up. That might be how you interpret it. And so on. And the horrors that are faced by women around the world, by homosexuals around the world, by anybody who doesn't comply essentially with the cultural norms in the Middle East, we can't count them. People are thrown off of buildings for being, gay. Women are stoned. They dig a hole in the ground, put the woman in the ground and stone her, because someone raped her, perhaps. She was the victim, but...
As part of his letter, he does say that, for example, he is against the governments in the Arab region because the United States is preventing them from imposing their Sharia. And also, he says, now this is something that really struck me. In the letter, he talks about the Nation of Islam, which he apparently is the leader of or was. It is the nation of martyrdom, the nation that desires death more than you desire life. What a statement.
Right. Well, they have no love for the physical world. Their goal is life everlasting after death. This is just a place to earn your wings, as it were, by taking down everything that the West would regard as good and moral, be it capitalism, be it individual freedom, be it property rights, be it free speech, all of that kind of stuff. That's all the product of Western philosophy, stemming back to the Greeks and through the Romans and through Christianity and to now, and through Locke and Jefferson and etc. That is to them anathema to what they see as the right way to live on this planet until you die, and the most right and they do see themselves as martyrs. That's their highest good, or their highest example of being virtuous. That is to take out the enemy who is only trying to take us out, you see, because they're the victims. All of this is cover for what really is actually laid out in that letter, which is a call for conversion of all to Islam or face death or face the might of the martyrs. That's all it says. And they're justifying the tearing down of buildings in New York City by plane attacks, the murder of 3,000 people in New York City by plane attacks. I think it was 3,000. In the name of religion, not in the name of Palestine. No one took the buildings down because of Palestine, right? So to even make the parallel now that we've had the attack on October 7th in Israel, and to in light of that, in the context of that, say that Osama bin Laden was right. He wasn't talking about Palestine. He was talking about the march of Islam on the planet.
He right? does mention Palestine in the letter, but only as one of many intrusions, as he would put it, into their sphere of influence. He talks about Somalia, Chechnya, Kashmir, Lebanon, and Palestine. So you're right, it's not simply about Palestine.
No, and the only reason he even brings up countries, I mean, there wouldn't be countries under Sharia law. There would not be countries, because countries are places, they're jurisdictions where men make laws. Men meaning capital M, not males. Where humans make laws for humans, right? You don't have countries in the ideal Islamic world. You've just got the Islamic globe. And that's why you're bombing New York City. That's why you're having massacres in France. That's why you're having massacres all over the globe, in the Netherlands. That's got nothing to do with Palestine land claims. That's just a cover. And the notion that, well, he hit first, we can get into this notion that he hit first and therefore he's in the wrong is utter nonsense. When it comes right down to it, it's about ethics and what team you're supporting. It's not about who struck first, and it's about the means you're using.
Let's listen to some of those TikTok people extolling the virtues of listening to the letter to America by bin Laden. The first clip that we'll play is by Douglas Murray on Sky News Australia of November 17th, followed by, after the bumper, a clip by Luai Ahmed on Twitter from November 18th, giving his opinion on what he's heard about these people discovering Osama bin Laden's letter to America. Back after this.
As we do every week, it's time to speak to the author of international bestsellers, including The War on the West, The Strange Death of Europe, and The Madness of Crowds. Douglas Murray, let's start with the suicidal self-loathing and stupidity that we see among the modern left, and they've reached a new low yet again. Have a look at this TikTok trend featuring thousands of what seem to be educated Americans talking about reading Osama bin Laden's letter to America, where he explains why he attacked the US. These TikTokers say this letter opened their eyes and made them reevaluate how they see the world.
Osama bin Laden's letter to America explaining why he attacked Americans. This has left me very disillusioned, and I feel the same exact way I felt when I was deconstructing Christianity.
I will never look at life the same. I will never look at this country the same. I will never... Please read it, and if you have read it, let me know if you are also going through an existential crisis in this very moment, because in the last 20 minutes, my entire viewpoint on the entire life I have believed and I have lived has changed.
In reading the letter, I could only think of this tweet that I saw the other day. Under settler colonialism, any kind of resistance is branded as terrorist because the only acceptable violence is violence by the occupier.
Douglas, we're in deep trouble, aren't we?
I think we are. The parents of these kids or young people have completely failed. They've completely failed to educate their children in any way whatsoever. Their children have become these empty-headed, empty vessels into which any ignorance, it seems, can pour. I'm amazed by this, and I there aren't many things I feel like I can still be amazed by, Rita. But I'm amazed by this, not least because Osama bin Laden's letter to America, his pre-9/11 rantings, you would have thought might have been slightly cast into a negative light by 9/11, for instance, and treated at least with the sort of amount of skepticism that you might apply to, say, a school shooter's manifesto. Not that any school shooter, appalling as they are, has ever come close to what Osama bin Laden managed to do in his benighted career. But secondly, the thing that's amazing about it is, of course, is that these kids seem to be kids, actually some of them adults, seem to be have their whole lives sort of turned upside down by something which I suspect most of which they had absolutely no understanding of. One of Osama bin Laden's chief criticisms of America before 9/11 was its involvement in East Timor. I would love to see if any of these young people in question know even what I'm talking about when I say the words East Timor. I once did a discussion about Osama bin Laden on the BBC with a left-wing editor, and I said East Timor in regards to Osama bin Laden, and in the break, I saw her Googling East Timor on her phone. the staggering idiocy of these people is just legion. But yes, there's always another circle to the inferno, isn't there?
To the miseducated Gen Z kids and millennials on TikTok who have been praising Osama bin Laden's letter to America without having a mature understanding of Islamic imperialism, history, geopolitics, or propaganda machinery. You, alongside Al-Qaeda's founder, blame and hate the West for all the evils in the world, like enslaving black people centuries ago. While black people are still being enslaved by Arab and African countries, right now, you hate the West for killing thousands of Arabs, when Arabs have been killing a million times more Arabs than the West ever did and ever will. You rage about the West hating women, when in most Muslim and Arab communities, women are not even regarded as full-fledged human beings by law. You scream about the West being evil while waving your rainbow flags when you would get killed or jailed in most Arab and Muslim countries for doing so. You are spreading an utterly misinformed Al-Qaeda narrative that Palestine is what radicalized the Arabic and Muslim communities, when in reality Arab communities have been radical and waging wars against each other since the dawn of humanity. None of you would survive 3 days in Afghanistan, Yemen, or Gaza. But you sit comfortably in your privileged homes in the West, defending and relativizing terrorists who want you and your freedoms dead. Before you make fools out of yourselves defending terrorists whose anti-West agenda falls in line with your anti-West woke mindset, allow me to use your favorite phrase, educate yourselves.
Some excellent observation there by Douglas Murray and Luai Ahmed on these TikTok videos about people's epiphany regarding the letter to America by Osama bin Laden. Basically, it boils down to this. These are ignorant people, and they're still ignorant people. That's not necessarily to disparage them. I mean, not everybody is a philosopher. Not everybody is a historian or a political commentator or a journalist who might delve into these topics in great detail. But I think it behooves people to do their homework before they go public and saying that this letter changed their lives in a way that they don't really understand, and they admit their ignorance. For example, we all know, at least Paul, myself, and those of us who are in this business of needing to know, we know about the forever war of the United States. We know about the deep state. We know about how things are manipulated in the media and the press, and how the public at large don't really pay attention to what's going on around them in that respect. So to all of a sudden read this letter by a terrorist telling people that unless you follow him, you'll be dead, we will kill you, and finding some good in it, it just baffles me. Paul, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I know the superficial thing that they've derived from it is the idea that, well, you struck first, so therefore we're just doing, you know, the work of justice. We're just striking back, which is utter nonsense. But we see the same thing on the streets of Toronto, the streets of the United States. Just in the last week, I'd say last few days, there are at least two really, well, three events that I can think of that have been hitting the news. First being in Montreal, Canada, two Jewish schools were shot up overnight. Luckily, no one died. No one was injured. Don't think anyone was in the schools at the time. But clearly a terror tactic to put bullet holes in the front doors of a school, right? They did this to two schools. One of them, I think they did it twice. If that's not an attempt to strike terror into the hearts of parents and children everywhere who are Jewish, I don't know what it is. And what purpose is served by such terror? Ultimately, it's trying to drive people away, get them out, get them to shut up, right? We also then had a few days ago, a woman in, I believe in the States, but it doesn't make any difference, somewhere in North America, put posters up on the wall or on the glass of a Starbucks, and then took some kind of paint or something and wrote messages all over the Starbucks, something to do with, you know, a pro-Hamas or pro-Palestine, whatever you want to call it, position. And she videotapes herself saying she did it, that she used the word, vandalized the Starbucks. She says it's not a crime. She's just defending, you know, the victims of Israeli aggression or something like that. 2 days ago, we had someone in Oshawa, Ontario, Canada, at a college. And she's a visa student, reportedly, from Palestine. And she takes to video, and as a lot of these young women do, they put on all their makeup and they get in really close and it's like a fashion shot for them. But she says that that Hamas is not terrorists and that she was sending in a message to all her Hamas peeps and that she hopes they do what they did on October 7th to Israel again and again and again. She says this again and again, like literally just keeps saying again, again, like a mad person. Again and again and again and again and again and again and again. Peace out and this kind of stuff, you know. Now, thankfully, Durham College, which she is attending and taking some kind of advanced biotechnology course, God only knows what should do with that knowledge, has brought the video to the attention of the local police and has said, we do not, you know, she doesn't speak for us. Well, thankfully, that's the least they could say. You know, there was no word, not that I could see, any word of support for Jewish people in the area. It was just a condemnation of what she said. Well, yeah, okay. But what has all this got to do with what's going on in Palestine? What do you think is going to happen in Palestine if you shoot a Jewish school in Montreal, if you vandalize a coffee shop somewhere in North America, if you send out a TikTok video to your peeps, you know, globally, but really just from Oshawa, Ontario, Canada, they still manufacture cars in Oshawa, but not that many, not like they used to. The Motor City, as it was called. So it's not going to have any effect, except domestically. What they're trying to do is radicalize people in Canada, in the United States. They don't care about what's going on in Palestine per se. These are efforts to radicalize people here. And they're saying that they're doing it as a reaction to what's going on in Palestine. The reality is they're young people who just want to have a lot of fun. They want to be shit disturbers and they want to be famous on TikTok. Well, they're famous and in prison, hopefully. But I think it's important for people to understand that protest and violence are not the same thing. Demonstrations and calling for murder are not the same thing. Free speech is not the same as saying anything you want and having no consequence. Free speech, for example, let's talk about that just for a second. They used to say, oh, you can't say scream fire in a crowded theater, you know.
When there's no fire, yeah.
Yeah, when there's no fire. Now, to some extent, that's a good example, because if as a result of doing that, people are killed as they trample one another, you literally have caused the death of people. And if you use your speech to, for example, fool somebody, oh yeah, if you give me $20, there's a guy around the corner, he'll sell you a sandwich. He'll give you a sandwich for free. It's my brother. Just give me the 20 here and he'll give you the sandwich. Well, that's, you know, you're defrauding the person, you're ripping them off. That's not a proper use of speech, and you should go to prison for that. If you tell a person that, oh yeah, I have no venereal disease. Do you remember Senyonga? There was a fellow named Senyonga in London back in the 90s. He had AIDS, and he purposely had sex, unprotected sex, with multiple women, condemning some of them to suffer the disease. And he went to prison.
Unfortunately, he died before the decision was rendered, so it was moot and they dismissed it.
Yeah. Right, right. So you can't just say, I'm allowed to say everything because it's all free speech. It's not. Free speech doesn't mean you get to say anything. Free speech means you get to speak your opinion, but you don't get to use words as weapons. That's not what free speech is about. Calling people to go and murder Jews over and over and over again is not free speech. That's crime. Aiding and abetting. That's what it is.
Well, you can say these things, but be prepared to be judged and face the consequences for your speech.
Absolutely. Or to vandalize. Let's talk about property. Property rights. Some woman says, she's just standing up for her Palestinian peeps or her friends or whatever she calls them, and she's defending. She's not defending anything. Or let's take property rights. The property rights of the various businesses are getting vandalized, or even of our, you know, publicly owned buildings like legislatures, what have you. You can't just go smashing things in the name of some cause. To smash in the name of the cause is to condemn the cause itself. To call for murder in the name of the cause is to condemn the cause itself. When you say that Hamas should murder Jews over and over and over and over and over again, you're saying Hamas is a pro-murder group. When you say we should smash the local Starbucks or vandalize the local Starbucks in the name of Hamas and what it's doing, in the name of Palestine, you're saying that the Palestinian way of life involves vandalizing, involves not respecting public property. You know, it's worthwhile to note that the people on the other side of this is Israel-Palestine dispute. We don't see them vandalizing buildings. I haven't seen, you know, Jewish groups coming out and vandalizing the local shawarma hut or whatever it is. Because it happens to be owned by a Palestinian, let's say, or because someone there gives money to Palestinians back home. You don't see that. They don't resort to you know, vandalism. I haven't seen Jewish groups signing petitions to their universities calling for the slaughter of innocent people living in, let's say, Palestine, or people living, you know, for the people to be moved out of the country if they're here and they just happen to be Palestinian, you know. There's a difference, you know, there's a respect for the Western way of life on the one side, and there's a violent attack against the Western way of life on the other. And that tells me everything I need to know about who's in the right over there. If the people here on the sort of pro-Hamas side are in favor of vandalism and aiding and abetting murder, okay, thank you. I know which side you're on. That's that side. And then if I see peaceful get-togethers and fundraisers on the other side, completely voluntary, okay, now I know what side you're on, too.
As a matter of fact, it's probably beneficial that these people be allowed to speak, at least, so that we can identify them. Now, Donald Trump has just come out and basically said that once he is president again, he will deport anybody who has come out on the side of Hamas and is not an American citizen. He will remove their visas.
Right.
They're gone.
Right.
And I think that is a just response because they're not American citizens. They do not stand the protection of American law when it comes to things like free speech. As a matter of fact, not even American citizens should be allowed to say things like kill all the Jews without consequence.
Right.
So this is the kind of response that we need from leaders, but instead we get some sort of vacillation between Islamophobia and anti-Semitism. For example, Justin Trudeau has in a speech basically just came out and said that we're seeing an alarming rise in anti-Semitism, almost as much as bad as the rise in the Islamophobia. And I'm going, oh man, come on.
It's very one-sided.
It's very one-sided.
It clearly is. It clearly is. And just because you're angry that you've been attacked does not mean you're an Islamophobe. You know, that's like saying, okay, your brother got beat up by seven guys in the street and they're all members of the Crips or the Bloods. And you're really angry about the Crips and the Bloods beating up your... Like, anger is not the same as unprovoked hatred, right? And that's what we're seeing.
It comes to mind, and it's Salim Mansour, our good friend Salim Mansour, has basically saying many times over, so that we don't forget it, that no religion, no community is a monolith.
Right.
If somebody is against Arab Palestinians who belong to Hamas, that doesn't mean that you're against Arab Palestinians per se. It doesn't mean that you're against all Muslims.
Right.
Because not all Muslims believe in this.
Well, in fact...
Now, mind you, a majority actually sympathize with this, and that's been borne out in Pew Research when they poll Muslims throughout the world, which is unfortunate, but not all Muslims believe this.
Well, and to that
point, we have to be very specific about what we're targeting when we target these actions. We're targeting Hamas, Hamas supporters, those who agree with Hamas.
You have to be careful also not to under-include. I mean, it wasn't necessarily Hamas who bombed the towers in New York City. It was Islamic radicals. So even, but to your point about not a monolith, even within Islam, we see murder of one group against another, you know, because there's, just like in Christianity, there's different kinds of Islam. And they hate each other as much as, you know, in Ireland, the Catholics and the Protestants were going at it, you know, bombing one another, shooting one another, beating each other up. So I think it's important not to limit this to Hamas, but also not to say that every single person who follows the Islamic religion wants to see the end of Israel or wants to murder all the Jews. But I would not say that it's only a slim minority of followers of Islam. I mean, followers of Islam. Followers of Islam, I think you cannot say with a straight face that, you know, hey, they'd love to lock hands and have their sons and daughters marry Jewish kids. I don't think that's going to happen. There's a real deep-seated and religious-based hatred of Jews, period. It's straight out of the Quran.
To your point, the body of one of the women at the festival in Israel was taken across the border into Gaza. She's dead and she's lying in the back of a pickup truck. And what do we see on video? Hundreds of Gazans coming out of their homes to spit on her body. Mm. You know, so it is not simply the perpetrators, the men who cross the border to commit the atrocities that we oppose. It is anybody who would support such heinous actions. Let's listen to Ayn Rand in the bottom of the hour here talk about the appropriate response to civilians in war. And we'll be back after this.
Why do you think people should be concerned about the nature of their government? Certainly the majority in any country at war is innocent. But if by neglect, ignorance, or helplessness, they couldn't overturn or choose a bad government and choose a better one, then they have to pay the price for the sins of their government, as all of us are paying for the sins of ours. That's why we have to be interested in the philosophy of government and in seeing to the extent we can, seeing to it that we can have a good government, because a government is not an independent entity. It's supposed to represent the people of a nation. If some people put up with Soviet dictatorship, not all of them, you know, but some do, as they did in Germany, they deserve whichever their government deserves. There is no innocent people in war. The only thing to be concerned with is who started that war. And once you can establish that it's a given country, there is no such thing as considerations for the right of that country, because it has initiated the use of force and therefore stepped outside the principle of right.
You should be drawing, not killing people.
I can do both.
How can you have such a casual attitude toward killing?
I take my killing very seriously, Doctor. You are an idealist.
I live in an ideal culture. There's no need for your kind of violence. We've proven that.
Your origins on Earth are from the American continent, are they not?
North America.
Yes, I've read your history books. This is a war for independence, and I am no different than your own George Washington.
Washington was a military general, not a terrorist.
The difference between generals and terrorists, Doctor, is only the difference between winners and losers. You win, you're called a general. You lose...
You are killing innocent people. Can't you see the immorality of what you're doing? Or have you killed so much you've become blind to it?
There are a number of salient observations I've made with regard to people empathizing with Arab Palestinians and Hamas. One, the refusal to make a distinction between targeting civilians, as is the purpose of the Islamic Resistance Movement, Hamas, and bin Laden's Al-Qaeda, and the death of civilians as unfortunate collateral damage, which is the position of Israel and most other nations. It's unfortunate, versus targeting civilians and children. The support for a ceasefire is number two. Support for a ceasefire or a call for negotiations with the Islamic Resistance Movement, when that group has said explicitly over and over again that they will never negotiate and never, ever end their attack on Jews and Israel until Palestine is cleansed from the sea to the river. That's the thing, is that they are openly advocating for genocide when Israel, of course, is not. As a matter of fact, if Israel were to perform a genocide on Gazans, there wouldn't be any Gazans. Instead, what happens is their population has increased considerably over the years.
Right.
And a third one is ignorance. The ignorance of the general populace regarding the situation in the Middle East, and the ignorance of how the actions of Western leaders, and this hits home, how the ignorance of these Western leaders has only made the situation worse and has perpetuated it.
Yeah.
When if they simply took the right stance, either stay out of it or end it, instead of placating these massacres, these people who perpetuate massacres and who are pure evil. You know, so those things, I think, are key. But key among those three things would be the difference between targeting civilians and collateral damage. What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, I think they serve two very different purposes, right? The person who intentionally goes and tries to terrorize, let's say Americans, first of all, because there's two different kinds of terror going on here. There's the terror as against those in Israel, where essentially I think they want every Israeli to leave the whole region, every Jew to leave the whole region. And then there's the terrorism like we saw in the United States, which I think is aimed at that goal of conversion. In other words, if you don't convert to Islam, you will suffer these attacks, because anyone who's on this globe who is not following Islam is against Islam, and they need to go. So that's the purpose of attacking in that case is to cause some effect among those people, right? To get them to do something. The purpose of, for example, Israel responding to such attacks, first by allowing people out, creating corridors so they can escape if they want to, so that they can demolish buildings that are close to the border, buildings under which there are all kinds of armaments and bombs and equipment and tunnels to carry out the destruction. That's a very different thing. That's collateral damage. That's, if you're still there by choice, or even because, you know, the bad guy wouldn't let you leave. And that's a lot of what's going on there too. Hamas won't let Palestinians move out of the area because they want to have human shields.
Well, you know, to that point, Paul, if I could interrupt, I actually think that Israel is doing things to their detriment when they send out to the Palestinian population, the civilians, leaflets saying, get out of Dodge, we're about to bomb this particular building.
Yeah.
What good is that?
Well,
so
it takes...
you destroyed a building, you've got a pile of rubble, when all of the Hamas people simply pick up a leaf and go, oh, let's move aside so they can destroy this building, but we'll take our weapons with us and then just move back a bit. To me, that's not how you end this. It sounds callous and cold, but I think if they see a rocket installation or an arms cache, they don't warn them. You just destroy it. Yes, innocents may, or civilians may be killed, whether they're innocent or not. But, you know, that's how you end it, unfortunately.
Well, or even if you wanted to say, we're going to start bombing in about 48 hours, if you don't want to be caught in the crossfire, you better move. And then if you've stayed, if you haven't even lifted a finger to move, don't say you weren't warned. At least in that kind of situation, you're not telling anybody where the next bomb's going to drop. It could be anywhere, as long as it's, you know, within Gaza. But I mean, I understand that potentially what they're trying to do is take out infrastructure, places where, you know, tunnels, storage facilities, and et cetera, make attacks on Israel easier. And maybe that's all they're trying to do, is lessen the capability of Hamas to carry out what they do. Yeah, I mean, I'd prefer to see them wiped out, but I'm reasonably convinced that if you took out every single person who considers himself a member of Hamas, all those shoes would be filled within about 24 hours. You're not going to stop the cause of Hamas by taking out Hamas. In fact, there's other groups that want the same things as Hamas.
An excellent point, Paul, in that in order to stop a terrorist group, you really have to stop the culture and the ideas that the group hold. And I don't think you can do it by simply killing today's crop of Hamas terrorists.
Right.
You have to address the philosophy. And when Western leaders bend over backwards talking about Islamophobia, if you dare to condemn these actions or condemn Osama bin Laden or condemn mullahs who in Iran are funding these things, then we're at an impasse. We're not given the tools to combat this philosophy, this
right.
culture. And
that's
almost like a difference. That's another chapter to the story. Right now, we have to look at the moment, or at least Israel does, because I'm of the opinion that, first of all, this is not Canada's war. We should not be in it.
Right.
We should not be giving. We can talk about it.
Sure.
You know, our leaders can talk about it for sure and condemn one action or another, but we should not be giving any aid to either side.
Not that we really could. Sorry. Even. I mean, Canada is not exactly a major player on this globe. Never mind in this war. But there is some damage being done, both by the federal conservatives and the federal liberals when they equivocate, right? Not necessarily between one landmass and another, or one like Hamas and the government of Israel, but when they equivocate between philosophies. You know, when they say, as you said, Islamophobia, that means fear of Islam. Islam is not a person, it's not a race, it's not a human being at all. Islam is a set of ideas. You know, I've never seen anyone coming up and saying they're going to do anything about, you know, anti-objectivism, but there's lots of anti-objectivism on the internet. You know, there's no objectivist race, there's no objectivist nation, there's no objective, but, you know, there's no shortage of people vilifying objectivism. But Islam, we're not allowed to do. And that, I think, speaks to a cowardice more than anything else. Again, it's when you say you're not allowed to criticize Islam, Islam says, mission, you know, step one achieved, right? We can't even be criticized for holding the view that the Jews should be purged from the entire globe. Okay. We can't even face opposition to that idea. You're not allowed to say that the holy book of all Islam refers to Jews as monkeys and pigs.
Let's listen to some more of Ayn Rand on the killing of civilians.
And you know the contradiction of international law? The attempt to make the use of physical force, which is war, subject to some kind of laws. You can't. You can agree by mutual consent not to murder prisoners or not to bomb women and children if it can be helped. But it's an agreement of no great significance, actually, because the idea of a war, which means two groups of men who have decided that they cannot reach any rational agreement and they resort to force. The standard now is who can bring the other one to submission by means of force. If they have been brought to that state, every single goes. Well, it's valid if both sides see an advantage in it. But the idea, don't murder women and children, I don't think is particularly relevant if you're murdering men.
What's the difference? And it's demonstrating Vietnam all the time because women and children are right there with the guerrillas. How are you going to make a distinction? If it is tactically necessary to bomb civilians during a war, you have to. More than that, it's your moral duty to do so.
The idea that an individual inside a country can be made secure from the social system under which he lives and which he accepts, willingly or unwillingly, even if he's fighting it, he still accepts he hasn't left the country. The idea that others should respect that man's right and collapse to aggression themselves. In other words, not be goddamn pacifist who would not fight even when attacked because they might kill innocent people. Look, if this were so, nobody would have to be concerned about his country's political system. If you could have a life independent of the system, which other countries and other nations respected, so that you wouldn't be drawn into an unjust war if you're an innocent victim. If that were so, we would not need to be concerned about politics. Why is it important to be concerned about politics? Why should we care about having the right social system? Because our lives are dependent on it. Because those systems, good or bad, are established in our name and we bear the responsibility. But right or wrong, nobody must put up with aggression and surrender his right of self-defense for fear of hurting somebody else, guilty or innocent. When someone comes at you with a gun, if you have 1 ounce of self-esteem, you will answer him by force, never mind who he is or who is behind him. If he is attacking you because he's out to destroy you, and this is what you owe to the sanctity of your own life, if you have self-esteem.
If I'm ever in doubt as to the proper way to at least look at a subject, I would turn to Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism, because she spent her life questioning how we should question and dealing with these factors that we see today in a principled way that transcend time and specifics. So when we hear her talking about the moral justification for collateral damage or going to war, or as she's talked about the fact that you really cannot have international laws regarding war because in an existential threat to your nation, the gloves come off.
Right.
Everything goes for your own survival, just as it would as if you were attacked on the street by a man with a gun. The gloves come off. If you have any ounce of self-esteem, you act. Listening to Rand is very clarifying of thought.
Well, and or it could be very confusing. I mean, let's play devil's advocate for a second. Imagine that you're listening to Ayn Rand and she's saying, you know, the gloves come off, it's war. She's not saying, because it might otherwise be assumed she is saying this, that if it's war, there's no one's right, no one's wrong. It's just fight for your side. But she's not saying that. In fact, she says that there is a right of basically the freedom, the advocacy of individual freedom extends to taking over a land in which there is no freedom. If you want, for some reason, to send government into an area where you know, rape, pillage, murder, tribalism, and et cetera is the call of the day, and you want to set up civilized rules with police forces and courts and laws that make everyone obey the basic laws of dignity and you know, respect for everyone else's freedom to choose, you're free to do that. You can use force to go into that land, set up that government, and make people conduct themselves in a civilized way because you're on the side of civility. There is no equal right for the gangsters, the mobsters, the tribalists, the collectivists, to use force to take away your individual freedom to choose, make choices for yourself. There, it is not the case that tribalism is the moral equivalent of reason, that tyranny is the moral equivalent of freedom, that collectivism is the moral equivalent of individualism. And as far as these rules, the whole point of totalitarianism and tribalism and irrationalism is to eliminate rules, to take what you want, to grab it. It's range of the moment. They are anti-law. They are pro-nihilism.
That speaks to Ayn Rand's observation on what should be the conditions for war. She said there's three conditions, basically, for whether or not you go to war with another nation. And one is your nation a nation that has conscription? Is your army a volunteer army? Number two, are you in the moral right? Is there a good and bad? Are you on the good side? Are you on the bad side? If you're on the bad side, you have no right to invade. If you're on the good side, perhaps, based on the other conditions. And the last condition was, is it in your rational long-term self-interest as a nation to get involved in this war?
Right.
Now, we look at the Israel-Hamas situation or Israel-Arab-Palestine situation. Israel does not have a volunteer army. Israel is in the moral right. Of all of the nations in that region of the world, they're a democracy. They are a freer nation and more or less in the right over the Arab Palestinians. Is it in their best interest to go to war? Sometimes it is.
Yeah.
Especially when it's their neighbors.
Yeah. I don't even call it war. The Palestinians aren't fighting a war. They're just doing little, what they call gas and dash, you know. You run in, you destroy some stuff, and then you run and try to avoid accountability. They're just vandals. It's Israel taking out the trash, as far as I'm seeing it. And that means you guys on the other side of the border, you've got 24 hours or 48 hours to sift the wheat from the chaff. Let the wheat get out of the way, but we're coming through and the chaff's going with the buildings. I don't see any problem with that. The other thing about, you know, the conscription idea, I can see that in the United States where that was a big problem. There was a lot of protest against conscription there. I don't know that it's true. I mean, I'm prepared to be taught, but I don't know that it's much of a problem in Israel to be told you're going to be, serving time in the military, because I think there you probably want to do so anyway.
Well, it's Robert A. Heinlein who said that if you can't get the men of your country to defend it voluntarily, then it's probably not worth defending.
Right. Right. And I don't think that Israelis think their own country is not worth defending. I mean, there might be a few ragtag morons, but other than that, I think that Israelis have built something quite civilized in a very harsh surrounding. They've put agriculture where it never could have existed before, and so they've got a lot to be proud for, and technology and everything else, and it's worth fighting for, and it's worth defending, and I think that's what they're doing. I've got no problem picking sides in what's going on, and I think they have every right, in my view, regardless of what Ayn Rand might have said about conscription. I think, in my view, she wouldn't have any qualms about Israel fighting back or taking out trash.
No, as a matter of fact, I mean, she is, in many respects, it sounds ironic, but very much pragmatic in prioritizing things. For example, she went and saw the launch of Apollo 11 to the moon. Now, she did mention that while I disagree with the very existence of a National Aeronautics and Space Administration sending guys to the moon just because we can do it, it's spending millions of what were taxpayers' dollars to do so, she said that if I were to take an axe to all of the administrations and bureaucracies in the United States, this will probably be the last one to go.
Right, right.
You could prioritize things, sure.
Of course, there's a hierarchy of values and of disvalues, right? Yeah, as you say, you have to pick a hill to die on. You don't just say, well, we're within the moral right, we're morally right to be able to attack, but do we really want to go and take over Palestine? Why would you want to? I don't think Israel wants to take over so-called Palestine. I think all they really want to do is push that border back enough that it's not so easy to lob missiles into Israel or to send rapist paragliders into Israel.
Yeah, they could very well be the definition of ungovernable as a people.
If they completely hate Jews, they're never going to be governed by Jews. I doubt they'll be governed by anyone except themselves, and even then, they're against government. The only government they respect is the government of God. I mean, it's a very religious group of people living there, and they see the only law that they're going to respect is Sharia. They don't all decide to do the crimes against Israelis, but I think for the most part, if you're living in Palestine, it's not as though you're weeping much for the Jews.
A number of political commentators have come out and said that the reason for this is simply not Sharia, but that is part of the reason, their upbringing into an Islamic dictatorship. It is hatred of the good for being the good. And that's a comment from Ayn Rand, an observation that of jealousy and greed on the part of a society that could have been good, but is not. Now, Douglas Murray, in one of his talks on Sky News as well, talked about how he was standing in front of Gaza just about a week ago with Gaza behind him and saying, this could have been Singapore.
Right.
You know, Israel moved out. They withdrew every single troop, every single Jew out of Gaza. Okay, here's your place. We're going to put up a wall around it so you don't come into our place, which is their right. It's a border.
Yep.
Egypt put up a wall saying you can't come down here because we don't like you either.
Right.
But that didn't stop the trade from going on. They could have become a free trade zone. They could have become a capitalist society. They could have become a good society like Singapore, which, by the way, I think has 20% Muslim. But they didn't. Why? Hamas.
Yep.
And the indoctrination of the children over their entire life to hate the Jew, to kill the Jew. And you see them in their school plays acting out, beheading Jews. It's quite a horrific hellhole. Mind you, people have called it an open-air prison. That's not because of Israel. That's because of themselves.
You know, we've got Thanksgiving coming up in the United States this week, Robert, and I thought we should just say a word about that. And I think it's appropriate to take a second to remember why we're sitting down and having turkey and cranberry and et cetera. It's because there's something to be thankful for. A great country, you know? Whether you attribute that to a gift of God or whether you attribute that to all the innovation and rational thought and activity around you, there's something not only to be thankful for, but to be proud of. And I would hope that instead of getting out there on the week of Thanksgiving and destroying a Starbucks, you take a moment to say, there wouldn't even be a Starbucks if there weren't this Western way of thought. There wouldn't be coffee being brought up from other areas of the planet so that you could enjoy it in a nice cup, in a safe environment, while listening to some jazz music. I mean, that would never exist but for the Western way of life. That is what we have to be thankful for reason and reality and for individualism and the defense of your life, liberty, and property. That is rare on this globe, and I'm a Canadian, and we have Thanksgiving, and that's what I'm thankful for, and I think it's the same thing that Americans can and should be thankful for. So take a moment and think about why you're celebrating Thanksgiving, because it's not just enough to be thankful. It's something to remember so that you can say, I've got something here I have to defend. And this is the most important time to remember how special it is, how special the United States is, how special Canada is, but how special the United States is and the importance of defending it. You can't afford, as Ayn Rand said, you've got to be political. You've got to defend the good you've got. You can't just let the nihilists tear it down.
You have to defend the right. And be sure to join us again next week when we can continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, stay right, do right, be right, act right, think right, and be right back. Here we'll see you then.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
Barack Obama says, we're not going to win the war on terror until we found Osama bin Laden. And that, to me, right there, proves that most Americans believe that there's just one guy running the entire operation, one Lex Luthor, evil guy, sitting in a cave, pushing evil buttons, go be evil there, be evil there, be evil there. Everybody knows it's not even a movement, it's beyond that. It's not a guy in a cave, just, you know, it's a thing with tentacles. That's not a good description, but you know what I mean.